This is Publishing Talks, a podcast about the publishing industry. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today, I'm talking to John Sundman. He's a writer and futurist and thinker about publishing who lives in Martha's Vineyard. How are you, John?
I'm great, David. How are you?
Good. Good to talk to you. You know, I wanted to talk to you, I think, in part because I know from having contact with you, you know, you've got ideas about publishing in the present and the future from the perspective of an active writer. And I think that's important. You know, I've talked to a lot of people who have different roles. I've talked to publishers, I've talked to agents, I've talked to technology people, futurists, you know, who are without portfolio, shall we say. And I think it's important to talk to writers and about writing, not specifically about your books, but about the way that you are carving out a place in the universe and figuring, you know, you've learned a lot of things, I think. So maybe you could talk a little bit about your back, you know, how you came to writing fiction and what you've done as background to talking about some ideas about publishing.
Sure. Well, I started out long before I became a writer of fiction. I was a technical writer. I got my job as a junior technical writer at Data General in 1980 during the Solo and New Machine days, and I wrote dozens of hardware and software manuals, and then I went to various other computer companies and became a manager of publications and so forth. So when I sat down to write a novel, it was just kind of, it was one of those, maybe it was a midlife crisis or something. It just kind of erupted out of me like the alien in the belly in the first Alien movie.
So when was that? Just to
that was 1995. I was working for Sun Microsystems at the time, and they had told me that I either had to move my family to California or take a layoff, and I couldn't take I couldn't find another job. So we moved to California, and I was there 9 months, and they laid me off. So we moved to Martha's Vineyard. We said, "The heck with it! I'll start my career as a freelance writer." And I got some advances to write some books about technology and sat down and ended up writing a novel instead. But
did you ever write the book that you got the advance for to do the...
No, I didn't, actually. I had two advances, and one was from my friend Tim O'Reilly at O'Reilly & Associates, who was from one of his editors. And I had proposed a book, and they accepted it, and I wrote a third of it, and I said, you know, I think this book kind of stinks. And they said, you know, we do too, so let's just forget the whole thing. And it was amicable, and they, you know, and then I had another, I was working on Linux for Dummies, and at that time, Linux was such a rudimentary state that it was impossible to write a Linux for Dummies book, because you had to be an expert to install Linux in 1994.
Well, you couldn't be a dummy.
You couldn't be a dummy, right? It was like how to get the thing installed was the first 300 pages, then how to do anything with it, you know. So anyway.
Right, so it's what the packagers of Linux are the ones who made it for dummies.
Right,
or
right.
At least better than, well, maybe a little higher than dummies.
Yeah, and I think you could write a Linux for dummies now, but at the time it was still very much you had to be a hacker to be able to do it. But anyway, I'm digressing. So I sat down and I wrote a novel. And I wrote the first draft of it in 3 months, and I was convinced that I had written the best novel in the whole history of the world, and I was going to become rich and famous. It was kind of a thriller. So I sent it to a buddy of mine who's a Hollywood actor, and he gave it to a friend of his who bought movie rights for MGM. And she read it on his recommendation. She went right to the top of file. And she called me up. This was like 4 days after I sent the book to Hollywood. She said, well, I read your book. I'm going to buy it. It's not for us, but I think you're really good. Who's your agent? And I said, I don't have an agent. And she said, oh, my God, you're going to be eaten alive. You are going to be ripped off. You need to have an agent. Call this guy in New York and mention my name. So I did. And he said, well, if Elizabeth recommends you, you know, I'll read your stuff. So he did. And he said, okay, I'll be your agent. And he read the manuscript. He said, I'll be your agent, but you have to rewrite it before I can show my boss. So Long story short, 4 years later, after several submissions both to Hollywood producers and to New York agents, after endless rewrites and endless new submissions, I said, "Oh, the heck with it! I'll publish it myself," which I did. That was 1999, and then the next that book is called Acts of the Apostles. It's kind of a nanotechnology biotech thriller about brain hacking and a crazy megalomaniac in Silicon Valley. And then I wrote another book in 2002, which I thought was aimed at a much smaller target audience. So I didn't even try to get a publisher for that. I just published it myself. And then I wrote another book called The Pains, which came out about 2 years ago, 3 years ago, which is kind of an illustrated dystopian phantasmagoria thing, kind of a graphic novel story. And that, again, I just published myself. And then, tell me if I'm going on too long.
No,
But
this is good.
about 6 years ago, I was working at home as a freelance technical writer. My phone rang, and a guy called up and said, "My name is so-and-so, and I'm an editor at Random House, and can I have read your book at the recommendation of Random House's editor-in-chief? And I found out you've got a bit of a cult following. Would you be interested in a two-book deal? Republish your book and you'd write a new one." I said, "Well, of course." It was very flattering. And I went down to New York, and they took me out to lunch and so forth. But there was no offer forthcoming. They said, "Give us an outline for your new book." So I gave them an outline, and they said, "No, we want a thriller like the first one you did." And so I wrote an outline, and they said, "Okay, good. We like the outline. Give us some chapters." So I wrote some chapters, and this is while I had a full-time job. And eventually, after like 6 months, there was still no offer. There was still talk of, "We're going to give you a two-book deal as soon as we like what you see." And I said, "Oh, forget it. This is going nowhere." So that was my first flirtation with a real book offer. And then last year, I did get a contract for the rights to my first book, which was by then 10 or 11 years old, with a publisher called Underland Press, a new indie startup, high quality imprint. So I have just completed a pretty thorough overhaul of the book. And matter of fact, it's so thorough that we're going to give it a new name and probably keep both books on the market because the new one is so completely changed from the first one. It's probably 50% of the second book's words are the same as the first book, and 50% have been thrown out and 50% added. So that's that. But I have a new book in the works that I financed through Kickstarter, and I'm behind schedule on it. It's called Creation Science, and it's about creationists and fundamentalist religious people, and it's about people inventing a new kind of DNA that reads in codons of four nucleotides instead of three nucleotides, and bioterrorism and the politics of bioterrorism. But it's also kind of on a meta level, it's about the science of how we create stories and entertainment and so forth. So that's my resume as a novelist.
Well, let's actually talk. I mean, actually, the Kickstarter thing is interesting. I think, probably, I know there are quite a few books that are being published, written or published or both, because of proposals on Kickstarter, but probably fewer books than maybe some other media. So I'm kind of curious about your experience in Kickstarter. When did you talk, maybe tell a little bit about how you did it. When did you come up with the idea of using Kickstarter, and did you write a what kind of a proposal did you write, and how much did you go after, and how long did it take to get it?
Okay. Well, it's an embarrassing long amount of time ago because the book isn't done yet. It was nearly 2 years ago. I forget how I heard about Kickstarter, but it was still in its infancy. I think it was a fellow named Robin Sloan, who's a pretty big mover and shaker. I think he works at Twitter now, but he's also a novelist who cranks out stuff like Stephen King. He gets writer's block that lasts about a fourth of a second. Anyway, I was working on this novel, Creation Science, and didn't have any money to I needed to find a full-time job. So I said, well, I'll see if I can get any backing for this thing. And I set a goal of $5,000, which of course would not sustain me to write the book, but would, pay my bills for a month or two and gauge my level of support. So I sent out individualized notes to everybody who had bought books, because I had sold books through my website. So I had a mailing list of people that I had actually corresponded with who were readers of my books. And some of them were quite enthusiastic readers. And I put together a range of different packages. So if you donate $2, I'll say thank you. And if you donate $5, I'll give you a copy of an ebook when it comes out. If you donate $15, I'll give you a copy of the paper book and an ebook when it comes out. And if you donate or pledge, when I say donate, I mean if you pledge $50, I'll send you one of each of my existing books in paper form. So you get three books right now, and then when the new one comes out, you get that. And then if you pledge $250, I'll give you all of the above, plus I'll give you early drafts of my work in progress, and you can see how it's coming along and give me feedback and so forth. And if you pledge $1,000, I'll give you can buy the all my notes and drafts and markups of one of my earlier books, like my complete, like papers for my archives after I'm dead and gone, and the various universities are bidding for them when I'm the next Hemingway. And so what happened was, I found out that I had a lot of very supportive fans. Some people kicked in $50, even though they already owned my books. A bunch of people kicked in $250, and these were people that I had
Wow.
only knew for over the internet, people I'd never met in person. But they said, "Oh, what the heck, John? You're my favorite writer, so sure, I'll back you." And one person put up $1,000 and said, "I don't want any of this stuff. I just want to support you. I think you're a great writer and need your help. So you don't have to give me anything. Just here's $1,000." So,
Wow. Wait,
and
you got $1,000?
I did. And so it's a well-to-do person, obviously, but still, he's a patron of the arts, and I'm one of the artists that he felt like supporting. And then at this happened to another person, a friend of mine too, who used Kickstarter. At the last minute, somebody came in and bid $750 on one of the higher price things. And then when it was presented, the charge card didn't clear. It turned out that this fellow was a legendary internet scammer. And I don't know what he was hoping to accomplish, because obviously if his thing didn't clear, I wasn't going to send him my stuff. But my friend got burned because somebody had pledged a big amount that put her over her goal,
Oh, and she had to do it.
and then it didn't, and then so she said, "Great, we've made it." But then when the charge cards, because the way Kickstarter works, if the person proposing the project, if their goal isn't met, then the cards aren't charged. So you have to meet your goal, and then if your goal is met, everybody who has pledged gets their credit card charged. So her goal had been met based on this person who represented they were going to make this donation, but it didn't clear their credit card. So that meant that her goal had not been met. And so she, didn't make it. She thought she had made it and was elated for a day or two. And then when she found out she hadn't made it, it was like, oh, great, now what?
Right. Now that's actually something probably people haven't thought of, is the idea that you could get scammed by somebody, and that it would, I mean, it may be just a technical issue, but it is kind of, I mean, people, I think the sense is that Kickstarter is this magic thing for writers and creators of film and musical projects. It's a pretty cool idea that, for people who don't know what Kickstarter is, it's, you put your project up on the site, and you ask for people, as you described it, to make either donations or pledges based on, and maybe some people actually don't offer the multiple levels that you did. I think actually that was fairly creative of you to think of giving the manuscripts and, because you have to figure out some value to give people if you're asking them for so much money. Although
Right.
obviously the person who's giving you $1,000 is really doing it because they want to be a patron, not because they're expecting something specific in return.
Right.
It's not they're getting a, they're not getting a, th it's not like some of the, I mean, it is more like NPR where, if you give them $1,000, they give you a lot of thank yous, but it's not like you're going to suddenly become, their best friend or something.
Right.
So that's great, actually. It's a
Yeah, it was good. And also, so you when you set up a, I don't want to go off on a long tangent about Kickstarter, but it's a very clever little platform because when you propose something, you have to choose a date and an amount you're trying to raise. So, let's say you choose a date that's soon and an amount that's small, or a date that's, let's say, in far future, an amount that's small. Well, you might hit the amount, but then it doesn't do you much good because you haven't got a lot of dough. And or if you but if you set your sights too high and then you don't reach your goal, then you don't get anything, you get zero. So I said, okay, I chose a month because I figured I'll know whether it's working or not in a month. If I can't hit up everybody on my email list and make my pitch in a month, and I made a little video and put it up on the Kickstarter site explaining what the project was all about. And my goal was $5,000, and I, when all the dust was settled, I cleared a little more than 7,000. So that's like an advance you would get from a publisher.
Right,
But
although
this is all from individual people. You go ahead.
no, it's well, although it is, you have this obligation now to write the
Oh,
book,
yes.
and of course
Absolutely.
you do with a publisher too. But it's not, I think it feels different to have an obligation to all of these people who trust you.
Absolutely, absolutely. They're all people that I got an email from a person 2 days ago saying, "Hey, John, what's the latest?" I put out 20 updates through Kickstarter saying, "Okay, here's the latest project on the book," and I've sent out a couple of apologies saying, "Hey, I'm sorry it's taking so long to write this book. I've also had to get a day job and pay the bills, and also it always takes me longer than I think it's going to." And people have sent that very, very nice notes saying, "Hey, it takes as long as it takes. We know that writing a novel takes work. So don't beat yourself up and just write it."
Well, no, I think that's actually, you have a relationship with them, and they, they're it's a slightly different than a consumer relationship with a store. It's a deeper, more authentic human relationship. So, if a store puts a book up on its site or in its list of forthcoming books, or if a publisher does that, or if a software manufacturer does it, then people get really irritated because they got excited about it. They want it. Where is it? It becomes vaporware that they're chasing. But when they're dealing with the originator, the creator, the person who writes the book, I think people are more inclined to be understanding. It's not just because they know it takes a long time to write a book and you're the only one writing it, not like you have a staff and a business, but also I think what you said, that they're connected to you, and you're because actually you're doing the other thing that's important, and that's as you're communicating. So it's not just dead space. They gave you money on day one, and now it's day 300. They don't have any clue what's going on. So I mean, by you, I assume you have to, if you don't, otherwise people would get really upset,
Right, right,
because they would think that maybe you did scam them and
right.
make off with their money, for the book not written. And a publisher who gives an advance and doesn't collect on it may be able to write that off as a bad business decision. But I think human beings, readers who give you money, I don't think they're ever going to forget that they,
Right, right.
I gave you $20. Ultimately, I want my book.
Yes, that's true. I think there might be some people would say, "Well, I guess the guy didn't have another book in him," but I don't want to do that to anybody. I really want to do a good job. And what I said in my last update was, "I'm sorry it's taking so long, but I do have a day job." And then I talked about the rewrite that I was doing for Underland, and I said, "I'm sorry that you came first, but I gave that work precedence. But I I have to pay my bills, So." So I and the one book kept bleeding over into the other, and I said I just didn't want Creation Science to be yet another warmed over version of my first book, Acts of the Apostles. I wrote it once, and then I rewrote it 35 times for my agents, and then I just finished a major rewriting of it for this new publisher. And by golly, I want Creation Science to be different, even though the themes are the same. I want the voice to be different and the plot to be different and the whole feel of the book to be different. I don't want to be like, I don't know, I don't want to mention any authors by name here, but there's some big name authors out there who just write the same book over and over and over and over again. And I guess they're wealthy and their customers like it, but I just, that's not my thing. So.
Well, so I mean, now you've actually gotten into some of the things I wanted to talk about, which is, how your experience as a self-publishing or self-directing author. And now you've done most of your books have been done in paperback originally, and then ebooks have come along subsequently. Is that right? I mean.
That's right. Well, the first book I did, Acts of the Apostles, I wrote it. It's in paperback, and but on the day that I announced it, I put the first 13 chapters up online in HTML format, and I said, "Here's the first start of my new book. If you want to see what happens in the rest of the book, send me $15 in the mail, and I'll send you the book." And within 2 weeks, I had like 300 orders, and they came in from everywhere. Came in from Sweden, from Korea, Singapore, Australia, and this was in 1999. And it's much harder to do that today. I mean, I was like one of the first people to do that. And so, and then a few years later, I was at a O'Reilly Technology conference, and when Creative Commons was announced. And I was talking to Cory Doctorow, who, do you know who Cory is?
Yes, indeed.
Yeah. And so anyway, I was chatting with Cory and said, "John, you should put your books under Creative Commons. It's this new thing where, the books are free and downloadable. You maintain the copyright, but blah, blah, blah." And so I said, "Oh, what the heck?" On the spur of the moment, I put both of my books that were then available under Creative Commons and had them on my website. And then other people, replicated them on other sites perfectly legally. And at some point, I calculated that 15 or 20,000 copies had been downloaded. And then I realized, wait a second, I could be selling these things. And at the time that I did that, I was selling lots of paper copies, but paper copies just slowly dried up. And I decided to sell the book on Kindle. So I did that. And of course, once you put the book under Creative Commons, anybody who has it has it. So there's no putting that horse back in the barn. But I stopped advertising on my website that it was available under Creative Commons. I figured if people will find it, great, more power to them. But I'm going to tell them to go buy it on Kindle for $3 instead of giving it to them for free. So that's what I do now.
So, and you believe that, I mean, I guess what you're saying is you believe that people should actually pay you for your books.
Well, if they don't, I'm not going to make any money because
Right.
they're not buying the paperbacks anymore in any quantity. I sell 50 Kindle copies for every paper copy, and part of the reason for that is that I sell books that mostly appeal to hackers and geeks, and I used to sell through bookstores that appeal to hackers and geeks, and those bookstores no longer exist. I used to sell through the SoftPro book chain and Computer Literacy and Stacy's in Palo Alto and in San Francisco and in Quantum Bookstore, which is right next to the MIT campus. And there was a bookstore next to Carnegie Mellon, and they've all gone out of business.
I know that is an unfortunate reality. I mean, there's a certain you get the tipping point effect now, where there are fewer physical bookstores, which makes it harder to justify printing books. I mean,
Right.
which is inherently more expensive than making ebooks, but because you have to deal with the supply chain, whether they're in your garage and you're shipping them out one at a time, or whether they're in somebody's warehouse. If there are fewer and fewer outlets for printed books, it makes it easier to take advantage of digital publishing. But of course, that has another effect, which is, fewer books available for bricks and mortar stores to sell of the type that you publish.
Exactly. And when my first book came out, I got a lot of great publicity from places like Slashdot and Salon.com, and it was selling pretty briskly. I went to bed one night and my Amazon ranking was a million and something, and I woke up the next morning and my Amazon ranking was number 54. And I was outselling Stephen King and Tom Clancy for a weekend. And that was all on the strength of a strong, but not, absolutely glowing, but strong review on the website Slashdot. And I got an order from Amazon for like, send us 412 of your books. And that was pretty amazing. And I woke up one night and the fax machine in my living room was going off, an order from Computer Literacy Bookstore. And I forgot where I was going with this thread, but I finally sold out of the first printings of my first two books, which were done offset press, and now I'm just fulfilling anybody who wants a paper copy can get them through the Create Space, Amazon's print on demand. And I think that the quality is almost as good as the offset, but really not quite as good. So I'm a little bit disappointed. But what I'm not going to do is invest all kinds of cash in building up an inventory of, I'm not just can't afford to go down that route again, especially since the sales have fallen off so much of the paper copies.
Well, so maybe you could talk, I mean, do a little prognosticating. There are hundreds of thousands of writers at this point. Probably not everyone is going to end up being a self-publisher, but more and more, whether you've been published commercially or whether you've never been published commercially, the opportunity to publish in a directed way, not necessarily through traditional means. And self-publishing, I think, may have, it's going to become a misused term in the same way that print on demand is really about digital short-run printing. Somehow, self-publishing is not always really what is being described. When you publish on Amazon, in a certain way, you're self-publishing, but really you're not because Amazon is the publisher. You're directing the publishing to occur. It's the author in charge rather than an active intermediary like a publisher that we've thought of in the past. But you've still got an intermediary, and that's Amazon in this case.
That's
So,
right.
but that aside, which is a whole other discussion. The question I have for you, the long-winded question I'm going to ask you, is, if you're talking to writers, and let's assume they and maybe writers of all different kinds, do you, having been doing this for a while, having had probably a longer, a lot more experience in it, and having done it for a lot longer than many people who are thinking about doing it now, what do you think of as the advantages and disadvantages of being in charge of your own publishing in this direct way?
Well, the advantage is that anybody can do it, right? Anybody who has, well, I should say virtually anybody can do it. Some people can't grasp the concepts or can't master the tools, for example, that Amazon has on its
Right.
site
Or
for
may not
formatting a
want to.
Kindle book, or may not want to. But it's there's nothing stopping anybody. If you have a book that you wrote yourself, and assuming it's not grossly obscene by whatever Amazon standards are, and doesn't they, they have a few basic guidelines of stuff they won't publish. But if you have a book that's in any way within the normal parameters of books that you'd find in a bookstore, you can publish it. You write it, you format it, and you push a few buttons, and there it is. So, the great advantage is that there's nothing stopping you from doing it, right? The disadvantage, of course, is how do you get any notice? How do you get it marketed? How do you basically how do you get it noticed? Because if 100,000 people publish their novels each week, that's a lot of noise out there. It's a lot of competition.
Right.
So I had my book that had a bit of a cult following, but when I was made it an offer from Underland Press, I took it just because after 10 years of doing this thing and glowing reviews and lots of success and lots of attaboys and people saying, "Oh, John's a real pioneer in self-publishing," I'd still only sold 5,000 copies of the thing. And
Which is not bad, by the way.
Well, it's not bad, but it's not enough to retire on. And I had sold, I don't know, at that time I'd sold maybe 1,000, Kindle copies. So I said, well, I think the book is great. I think it's better. It's in the class of a Michael Crichton style thriller, and he would sell that many books in an hour. So if I'm going to see if the book has that kind of potential, let me try it with a publisher and see if they can do anything for it. So that's, the advantage of going with a publishing house. So I'm gonna, that new version isn't out yet, so I don't have any data on whether it was a reasonable thing to try or not. It was certainly a whole lot more work rewriting it than I bargained for. I found one of those things that a lot of people say don't exist anymore, an editor who was really a nurturing, caring, demanding, persnickety, perceptive editor. So I was kind of hoping she'd just rubber stamp everything I wrote and say, okay, good, ship it. And she was saying, no, not good enough, do it again. And I was saying, mommy, mommy, I've been doing this book for 15 years, please let me go.
Well, so
But
and what is a self, if when you're doing your own publishing, the impulse that you just described, which is, when you described earlier, there's nothing between you and the impulse to publish. Doesn't that run the risk? I mean, this is an obvious question, but doesn't it run the risk for an author to take the easy route and say, this book is done. I love it. It doesn't need editing. I don't want to edit it. I'm
Oh,
finished.
absolutely. Well, so let's step back a minute, David, and we say, what has been the perception in the public mind of self-publishing books? Let's go back 10 years ago, 15 years ago. Well, the perception is they're crap, right? They are books that were not good enough to get picked up by a publisher, and that's why they're self-published. So the presumption that's still pretty strong in a lot of people's minds, although it's changing, the presumption is that a self-published book is inferior in almost every way to books out of conventional houses. So over my, 12 or 13 years now as a self-publisher, I've done lots of book swaps. I find some self-publishing person who's got a book, or we find each other, and I send an email saying, hey, how about one of mine for one of yours? And I've purchased a lot of self-published books, and I'll tell you, a lot of them are crap, and so how would I say, the prejudice is not totally unfounded. Of course, lots of books that come out of conventional houses are not to my liking either, but so there is that situation when somebody who thinks they're a great writer, in fact, is not a great writer, and they publish their book and they think it's going to go to the moon, and they sell to their family and friends, and then that's it.
Well, and also there is another corollary to this, and that is there are plenty of not very good books that actually sell really well.
Yeah, that's true.
So there's no, I mean, I do agree. I think that there is an unfounded, partially founded bias against self-publishing among some people, and that is kind of paint the broad brush, and that is if it's self-published, it must be bad. And I know there are reasons for that, but I think that what's happening is the stigma as more and more serious authors, more and more writers who've published 10, 15, 20 books enter the arena and start publishing their work themselves. The stigma has to go away. But what you wonder about, of course, in this is, the traditional editorial role, whether, not necessarily, it doesn't have to be performed by a traditional conventional publisher, but the editorial role is really important. And there are a lot of people hanging their shingles out as editors. There are a lot of people hanging their shingles out as book designers, cover artists, all the services that go into making books publishable, whether it's ebook or print book. There are plenty of people around who will say, besides, I'm a writer, there are plenty of people around who will say, yes, and I'm an editor, and I'm a book designer, and I'm a publisher. I can do all these things. And of course, the odds are in all of these activities, there's probably an 80-20 rule or maybe a 5-95 rule that says out of every 100 books published, 5 are truly excellent, or some number is truly excellent. But my supposition is that except for the people who bypass publishing with an editor in some way, or that the average rule will still apply. For the people who bypass, the odds are worse because even good writers, even great writers need editors.
Yes.
And in some ways, great editors have made great writers. So, I don't think that's changing just because the way the business operates is changing. I still think there's a place for really good editorial thinking and really good editorial application. But I just don't think that it's impossible to find that among the self-published books.
Well, that's true. And let me give you a little bit of my own background as it relates to editorial input, and then make some observations about what I see around me in the rest of the self-published world. I had been, as I said, I had been a manager of technical publications at three or four different computer companies. At one point, I had 40 technical writers reporting into my group, and I had editors reporting to me and writers, and I marked up every manual that came out of my group. I took a personal interest in everything that came out and I was brutal. I had that red pen, and people used to save markups from me to compare who got more savaged by me. And as a technical writer myself, when I was writing technical manuals, I routinely got my work savaged by engineers and editors and so forth. So I was very comfortable with the idea of, bleeding red ink all over the page. And I'm not thin-skinned about that at all. When I wrote my first novel, Acts of the Apostles, what ended up being my editor was the agent that I got hooked up with, who said, "Before I show this to a publisher, I'm going to have to love it." And he just went over and over and over and reshaped it. And meanwhile, like, my wife is saying, "Okay, isn't it, enough? Haven't we spent enough time on this little, fantasy of being a novelist?" And it was very, very frustrating, because I'd think of something was done, and the guy would take 2 weeks, and then he'd write back, "No, not good enough," and he'd send me his markup. And then after he was done, he showed it to the Hollywood people. And the Hollywood people said, "This is great. This would make a great movie, but your story takes place over 2.5 years, and we need it to take place over a weekend, because movies have to move faster. So rewrite it so it takes place over a weekend or something." And it was literally, or almost literally, that much of an extreme. So I rewrote it for Hollywood to, like, sell the movie rights, and visions of million-dollar contracts dancing in my head. And so those were my editors on the first book. And it was, believe me, the final book that came out, even though there were typos in my first book as I printed it, which readers were not hesitant about pointing out to me, there were lots of typos, but the writing was tight. And the second book, I said, "Okay, I'm not going to make that mistake again." I had five or six people whose opinion I respected as readers and as editors, and I gave them what I thought was my completed draft and asked them to mark it up, and they did. And on my third book, The Pains, I just chose one person who was had a background in publishing herself, and she had come from being an editorial assistant and an editor at a New York publishing house, and was now a computer technical writer. And she was a fan of my stuff and said, "I'd love to edit your next book." And so she was much more of a partner rather than somebody I gave a draft to when I was done. She was somebody that I worked out ideas with before I started writing. And then she copy edited and really massaged the thing.
Well, you've been lucky, and
Yeah.
not everybody will be. So, listen, I'm sorry to say we've run out of time, but it's been great talking to you, John. And
Yes.
I think actually it's pretty interesting for a lot of people who are listening. I hope they'll take a look at your website, which is wetmachines.com, WETMA, sorry, pl singular, WETMACHINE.com. pretty interesting blog and website there, and it's got all your books listed. And we can go on Kickstarter and look you up there as well.
That project is Creation Science and on Kickstarter, so look for that.
Thanks, John. This has been Publishing Talks, a podcast about the book industry. I've been talking to John Sundman. This is David Wilk. Thanks a lot.